Okay, so once again, welcome all to the Q&A session for the OPC-UG. I will stop the sharing. Oh, I guess I got the sharing stopped on me, so that's fine. We have quite a bit of material on for the agenda tonight, but we may have time at the end. So if anybody has additional questions, by all means, after the main part of the presentation, we'll take any additional questions that we have time for. And so I don't take up too much of everybody's time. I will now kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome everyone. Now, as Chris said, we have quite a bit of material, so we'll get straight into it. And our first up is a computer basics item. This question came in. Basically, how do they copy files from one drive to a different drive? Typically, from the hard drive to a flash drive, or from the computer to or from a USB drive to the computer. So basically, how do you copy files between two drives? And there's lots of ways to do it. And if anybody has anything different than what I'm going to show, please feel free to chip in. But personally, I would suggest just using File Explorer and the Windows file management program. And it's a graphical user interface, so it's really easy to find the files you want and copy them where you want to. So basically, we've got this, we want to copy some important files. I've got this list of important files here on my C drive. And I've got a flash drive, which is plugged into the a USB port, and it shows up on my computer as drive E. So basically, how am I going to copy these files from this folder on drive C to a folder on the USB drive? And one of the things I like to do is I go to the View tab in Explorer and check this box down here, which says item checkboxes. So that essentially enables these checkboxes like this. So you can select files very easily. So you get individual checkboxes if you choose one file or multiple files. But this button right here is kind of a global check. So you can select all or you can deselect all just by toggling that button. So basically set this in the View tab and then go to the Home tab. When you click on this multiple select button here, you can see that it highlights all of the files that are in that folder. So now I'm ready to copy those. So basically, I've got them all highlighted now. So now I'm going to use this copy icon. This is why I went to the Home tab, because it gives me this on the ribbon. So I've got basic copy and paste. So I highlight my files on the C drive, I click on copy, and then I navigate to the next drive. So I'm in the left-hand panel here. I scroll down till I find my flash drive, which I said was drive E, and then I find the folder that I want to copy my files to. So I've created this folder called important files copies. And once I've done that, then I can select the paste icon because the files are already copied to the clipboard essentially. So I just click on paste and it pastes these files into that empty file folder. And what I can do right now is I can do a live demo. So if I bring up File Explorer, and by default, I've set it so it actually brings up my data drive, which is drive D. So let's go find here's the important files folder on drive C. And what, right there. And what I said I want, I've already set it to do the checkboxes. Another important thing here. This other checkbox here, file name extensions. I would suggest you have that thing clicked so you can be sure that what you've got is a PDF file and a text file and a PNG file, and none of these folders or none of these files are actually EXE files, i.e. executable files, hiding as something else. So checking file name extension does that for you. All right, so I can I've navigated down to drive C and important files. I can check these three files, so I select them all. I go to home, and I say copy. Now I've copied those files to the clipboard, so now I can go to, let's go to drive D for a change. And I've still got my copies folder here. So if I select that, you can see that it's empty, but now you can see that paste is highlighted. So if I just click on paste, then it copies those three files into the empty folder. So I've copied my files from drive C to the second drive, my backup drive, if you like. So what we'll do now is we'll just blow those away for a second and move this out of the way and go on to option two. So option two, it starts off the same way. We're going to select all the files from our C drive. But now what we're going to do is we're going to scroll down on the left-hand side panel here until we find the right drive and down to the right folder. And then what I'm going to do is I'm just going to leave these things highlighted, and I can just left-click, hold it down, and drag these files over and drop them onto the folder that I want to copy them to. Not only works because I'm copying from one disk to another disk. If I did that on drive C, I would actually move the files. I wouldn't copy them. But if you're going from different disks, then it's you can just drag and drop. Now, one caveat on this, which I have done lots of times, be very careful highlighting the folder that you want, because it's really easy to come down here somewhere and let go of the mouse, and it will copy it to some folder in the middle here, and you've got no idea where they are. Now you've got to go find them using some kind of search technique. So be a bit careful on doing that. So again, I think we can demonstrate that if I bring up File Explorer again. And now I'm in drive D. So let's go to drive C and important files. So here's my files. So again, I'm going to select them all by just clicking on that box. And then I'm going to go down to drive D, and here's the important files folder. So now I'm just going to left click, hold it down, and drag those files across. You see it's picked up all three files. And if I let go now, it's going, see now the problem is it wants me to go to like EDR NAS files 2012, and I don't want to go there. So I've got to keep going down until I get to the right folder, and then I just let go of the mouse. And now if I go to drive D and important files copies, you can see that I have my files again. All right, so let's blow those away one more time, move this guy out of the way, and talk about the way that I normally do it. I actually like to use two instances of File Explorer. And Windows 10 is nice in that way because I can click on the File Explorer window and open it. And then if I click on it a second time, I get a second instance. So what I normally do is I'll put my source folder in the top left-hand corner here. I'll select all the files I want to copy. In this window, I'll find my target folder. So this is drive E. And then I just drag from this window to that window and let go. And then for me, I'm absolutely sure that I'm copying to the right folder. So that's typically the way that I would do that. And if I can get the slide to advance, I will show you again. Okay. All right. So here's here's File Explorer. There's drive C. There are important files. So I can highlight all those guys. And now I'll just go to my taskbar on the main computer, load up a new instance of File Explorer. And I've already set it so it opens in D. So again, I choose my target folder. I want this copies folder. It's empty. So I've selected my files on drive C, and I can just drag the whole three and let go, and it copies them to the target. So those are the three ways that I can think of copying files from one drive to another drive using File Explorer, which I think is probably the easiest way. So Chris, did anybody come up with any better ideas, better mousetraps?
We have some comments in here. Michelin's saying the ribbon has been removed in File Explorer in Windows 11. So we'll wait and see what the release version of Windows 11 actually looks like. B says she's on her cell phone tonight because the computer's backing up since 8 o'clock this morning and he's asked to do. I'm not sure if it was safe to use Zoom while it's working. Quite frankly, yes. I use my computer anytime that EaseUS is working in the background. It tends to be a little bit slow because of EaseUS working, but you shouldn't have any difficulty with that. Michelin said, isn't it easier to drag and drop the files from one folder to another? So you showed how to do that. Tom says you can drag with a right click. Then it gives you the copy or move choice when you release it. And that's what I typically will do. So because you have to remember, if you're moving the files or copying the files from one drive to another drive, the default is copy. But if it's on the same drive, it defaults to move. So if you do a right click, it actually gives you that pop-up menu that you see on Alan's screen now, where you can actually choose to override it. You can do the default, which is bolded, copy here, or you could choose move, and then it'll be a move operation, or you have the ability to create a shortcut. Yeah, so that's Stefan says the defaults for drag and drop varies depending on source and destination, which I just mentioned. If someone isn't comfortable with drag and drop, I'll can have two windows open and use the copy paste. Yes. So that, I guess, is the further option, Alan, is you can still do it as a copy paste with two windows.
Yeah, I see that the paste is like, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is an example, Chris, where I use right click and I choose move. So yeah. Now it's moved the files from drive C, and now they're drive only D. on drive D.
Okay, and that's all we have in the questions and the chat.
Good. All right.
Okay. So thanks, Alan.
So the next item is a couple of shares, actually, from Stuart. So Stuart is going to unmute his microphone. And, oh, no. Yes, it is. Yeah. Stuart's ready to go.
I am. Okay, well, there's been some discussion about maps lately with... for various reasons, different ones. And something I stumbled across in the Google Play Store several months ago is called Canada Topo Maps. And it's produced by a company from Germany that does maps for countries all around the world. I figured since I don't even have a passport anymore, I'd just focus on Canada and download that, the free version of that. And it's pretty complete. What attracted me in the first place was that it has the old traditional government-produced topographical maps that give you elevations and the lines and shows you where the swamps are when you're trying to find that deer you shot and you're not sure which way it went. But there's a lot more than just that. I'm just looking at it now on my phone, and if you say choose a layer, there are 25 different layers that it offers in the free version. And there's the Canada Matrix, which is the essential topographic, and the Canada Base Map, another Canada Toporama. Digital Elevations, British Columbia Roads, the Open Street Maps are all there. Open Street Map Cycling, outdoors, landscape, topographical, ESRI, topographic maps, whatever the heck that is. I have no idea.
ESRI is a GIS system.
ESRI. So there's ESRI, topographic, street, aerial, Earth at night, Bing roadmaps, Bing aerial, Google roadmaps. Google got in here somehow. Google Terrain, Google Satellite, the National Hydro Network. I suppose if you work for a hydro company, that would be handy. Hill shading overlay worldwide. And this is the free version. So if you stumble, if you're interested, it's really worth taking a look at, because it's got all these different maps in one app. And if you feel like coughing up $17, you can get the paid version, which will get rid of the little advertisement across the bottom, and maybe find some more features. I haven't done that yet myself, but I've almost got $17 in the Google Play Store account, so maybe soon. Maybe soon. Okay, I really don't need it, but it would be fun.
The next one is yours too, Stuart, on a couple of slides.
Oh, right. What was that? Oh, yes. The QR scanner. Some time ago, a lot of things happened in my past. I found the Sophos Intercept X for mobile app, which is a great little security app that scans stuff that you're doing while you're doing it with the phone. And it never bothers me, so I guess I haven't done anything wrong. But I happened to accidentally open it a little while ago, and I found that there was a QR scanner built into it, which is a great little extra function, because everybody's always looking for a QR scanner app. And every time I'm reading articles on Android Authority or any other mobile-specific publication, there's always lists of bad apps that you should avoid, and QR scanners must be the worst offenders. There are more and more people that are trying to get into your phone through a malicious app, and everybody, QR scanners and games, I don't know, just it seems to be the way to get into a phone. But if your security software app, it is on your phone and you trust it enough to use it for security, which I guess you're doing, its QR scanner ought to be pretty safe too. And as the slide here says, I tried scanning my COVID vaccination QR code and it wouldn't open it. Everything else I tried to open, it would take me to a web page for that particular code and give me information and prices and all that sort of thing. But my passport code, no, it just said, you can copy this to a clipboard and try and fool somebody else, but we're not going to open anything up for you. So,
okay, thank you.
Do you have any comments on the app itself, Alan? Because I don't even use it, but I know you have.
Yeah, I use it as the online, on the onboard virus scanner, and it just sits in the background and chunters away. Every now and again, it will tell me that something or other is clean, which is fine.
Yeah.
The other thing it has embedded in it is an authenticator, which is great if you're using a service that requires that. Basically, you'll be logging onto a website, and in addition to a user ID and perhaps a password, it will ask you for a security code. And the phone generates the appropriate security code, which you then type into the browser, and you can log on. So it's like a two-factor authentication type thing.
I'll have to look for that one.
It's not just the scanner that matters. I mean, Google camera will scan QR codes, but it depends on what the QR code is, because it can lead you to a malicious website, or even worse, it can actually send some commands to your phone to delete stuff, to make expensive calls to strange places in the Caribbean. It can do a variety of things, so you do want something that checks the security of where that QR code leads to.
Right, like a security program.
Yeah, well, that's what I suspect that this thing is actually doing, is it's doing some checks for malicious activity before it actually does anything. So, but I guess it's probably a little bit opaque as to exactly what it does. But
yeah. Anyway, well, thanks again, Stuart. That's really interesting stuff. Right, our next thing is a share, which is from Chris.
Yeah, this is something I came across that I just thought was a really cool service that's available. So it allows you to follow the path of a drop of water that you drop in any waterway in the continental United States to either the ocean or a Great Lakes or the border. And all you, I'm going to do this as a share if it works for me. And I'm just going to say yes. And River Runner... share. Okay, so is everybody seeing now? Yep. Okay, good, thanks. I have it in a little bit of a small window because I did some tests with Alan, and it looks like the number of pixels in the area that I'm sending has an effect on the performance at the other end. So normally I see this in a little bit of a larger window. So it has a location box in there, and so I'm just going to type in page. And I'm going to select Page, Arizona. Now, what it does, it says it's finding the downstream path from Page, Arizona, and then you have to wait through this, going through the cycle. And then it's going to go down, and it's going to fly along the path. And you can see that I can, I'm going to drop it down to most detail, which goes the slowest, and it just follows along. And shows you where that drop of water is actually going to go along the 1,149 kilometers along the Colorado River. And you can use this to go to faster. It zooms up a little bit higher. It also doesn't follow the river quite as accurately. So if you have a lot of bends, it'll skip some of the bends and things like that. So I often will tend to go down into the more detail. You can reverse your course and go forwards and pause it and things like that. So I just thought this was a really cool service that you can use for – I wish they did it for Canada too, but anywhere in the continental United States. And you can see in the top left there's a map of the U.S. and it shows you where the path is that it's going, and the red dot shows you where you are along the path. So kind of neat. So I just thought I'd share that. If there's no questions, that's all I got to say about it.
Okay, let me get back to mine then. Okay. All right, so there's the URLs in the chat window if anybody wants to give that one a whirl. Okay, the next thing, I have a share coming up. Micheline has already talked about Windows 11 not doing something or other, not having a ribbon anymore in File Explorer. Well, I have a little problem because none of my computers will upgrade to Windows 11. And I was amazed to find that my brand new laptop is almost 7 years old. It's a speed demon, or it was back then. It has a Core i7 CPU, but that CPU is fourth gen. And of course, Microsoft are going to cut off Windows 11 at, I think, eighth gen. So, and this one's way too old, and my other computers predate this one, so nothing is going to run Windows 11. However, most of my computers, in fact, all except one, were dual booted, running Linux. And I actually run Linux most of the time. So the question became, if none of my computers will go to Windows 11, I mean, I can certainly run Windows 10 until 2025, but I was just wondering, could I actually make the switch and use Linux exclusively and become Windows free? So I'm inviting you to kind of join the journey. I'm going to follow up on this over the next few weeks and see how far I get. And you're welcome to join me. So I created myself a to-do list. The first thing was to install Linux on the last computer that is Windows only. Then I need to identify how I use Windows 10. How I use Windows 10 in terms of needs, I guess, rather than wishes. And then once I found those things that I use Windows 10 for, are there Linux-based alternatives? And if there aren't specific alternatives, are there any kind of workarounds that will allow me to move away from Windows completely? Or, as it said in italics, are there going to be any showstoppers? Is there something that I do in Windows that I can't possibly do on a Linux machine? So those are all the questions, all of the items on my to-do list. And I'm going to start tonight by discussing item number one. And item number one is this Asus T100 hybrid computer. And it's 2014 vintage, I believe. It's a hybrid in terms of it's got a detachable keyboard. So you can use it as a tablet, a Windows-based tablet. And you can see by the screen here, originally it came with Windows 8.1. And you can use it as a tablet, or you can dock the tablet to the keyboard, and then you have a mini laptop. This is like a 10 or 11-inch screen. The problem with this machine for Linux is that it's using a Baytrail CPU. It's a quad-core CPU, and it's 64-bit, but it uses a 32-bit bootloader for some reason only known to Asus and Windows or somebody like that. So when I first got this machine, I played around with it quite a bit because there was a Linux group was trying to develop a way to load Linux onto this computer. And I followed along with a whole bunch of the things that they were doing. And eventually I managed to brick the device completely. And like by bricking, it would not boot. It wouldn't power on. I couldn't get into BIOS. I couldn't get to the settings. I couldn't do anything. However, it was still in 2014 and it was under warranty. So I figured it was probably the manufacturer's fault to be able to load Linux on any computer. I've never had a computer I couldn't load Linux onto. So I sent it back to them and told them it was bricked and didn't tell them how I'd bricked it. And they sent it back running Windows 8. And subsequently, I updated it to Windows 10, and it's been running fine ever since. Having bricked it, I was very reluctant to go back to Linux, mainly because I turned this machine into an e-reader. I was using the tablet to read e-books, and I also took the little baby computer as a travel laptop and used it for email and surfing the web and making backup copies of photos from my digital camera and that kind of stuff. So because it was useful, I didn't really want to brick it. Now it's out of warranty. But now 2021 comes around and they're telling me it's much easier to install Linux on this thing these days. So I said, what the hell? I'm not going to Windows 11 on this thing anyway, so let's see what we can do. So one of the Linux distro I've been using for a number of years is Linux Mint. And Mint has a user forum. So I typed in the T100 and see what was on there. And I found this guy who said he'd been trying to install it. And after a couple of days, he was able to do it with ease. So I thought, well, with ease sounds good. I'll give it a whirl. It turned out it actually was pretty simple. There's only one step that's different from a regular Linux install. And I've done dozens of Linux installs, so I know exactly how to do it. So step one, you download the distro, and I use the brand new or the latest release, Mint version 20.2. I like the Cinnamon edition because it has a very Windows-like user interface, the desktop. So I downloaded it from the Linux Mint website. I used Rufus, which is a Windows program, to burn the ISO to create a live USB disk. So I can, I've got a bootable USB, which has got the Linux distro on it. And here's the trick for the T100. I also had to download a 32-bit bootloader, and that was available on GitHub. And all I had to do was download that file and then copy it onto the USB drive into the boot folder. So then once I'd done that, I need to turn off the secure boot in BIOS. That was actually already done, actually. But to load Linux, you have to turn secure boot off. And then basically plug the USB drive in, boot the computer from the USB drive through the BIOS settings, and then run the install program. And I always choose something like alongside Windows. So basically, it automatically sets up a separate disk partition to install Linux and probably a swap drive. And then it creates a grub boot menu, a grand unified bootloader menu. So when you boot the machine, it gives you the option of either booting into Linux, which is the default, or you can select to boot into Windows. So you get dual boot functionality. So that turned out to be really easy. As I said, it was that one little step where I had to copy the bootloader file. But other than that, it was just a straightforward install, and it's basically working flawlessly. So going back to my to-do list, we've ticked off number one, and next week I'll take a look at how do I use Windows 10, and we'll see where we go from there. Okay, anything in the chat where...
Yeah, we just had from Stefan, the switch to Linux is all about the apps, i.e. can you find a Linux app that will open at your existing files? And Eldon says, I always wondered about Linux. You somehow get a copy of the OS and use it, but then what? Does the user go back to the source for updates? What if you change something on your version of Linux? This is outside tonight's discussion, but it's something I wondered about, so something we can move forward with, I guess. Tom has a question about the T100. He has one. Is GPS working in Linux?
I don't know because I don't use GPS on that.
Okay. And have you considered using eMMC as the data disk and having separate TF or micro SD cards to boot Windows, various Linux versions, or the Chromebook?
You can't boot the micro SD card on T100.
Okay. He says it's easy to keep the micro SD card inside the T100, but yeah, if you can't boot from it, then that's a non-issue.
But I do use a separate data disk partition on that machine. It's just like all my other machines. It has Windows, data disk, Linux, and swap.
Yeah. Okay. And Lawrence just says, kudos. I was going to be betting against you updating that particular laptop due to a lack of compatible drivers. So congratulations.
Not me. That was the problem in 2014. The hardware was so weird and wonderful. It was hard to get all the drivers working for it. It's a number of years on now, and this group's been working hard at it. Clearly, they've also upgraded the Linux kernel to support the Baytrail CPU, is what I think's happened.
Yeah, right. Okay. Okay, that's it for the chat.
Okay, thanks. So the next thing we have is a computer basics item, which is provided by Stefan, and Stefan is going to share his own screen.
Great. So sharing. So you should see my presentation.
Yes, we do.
So we'll start by covering how Excel deals with dates. In Excel, and it's the same thing for most, like in Access, it's the same thing. They use the same data format. The beginning of time in Excel is January 1st 1900. So if you try to create a date before that, Excel will give you an error message. And the main function that is used in Excel is the date function, and the date function has three arguments. So you put the year, the month, and the day. And that function will return to you what they call the date serial. And the date serial basically is the number of days since January 1st, 1900. So if you type this as a formula, date 1900, first month 1, day 1 will return 1. If you put the 2nd of January 1900, it will return 2. And if you, as an example, if you put the 30th of August 2021, it will return 44,438. So that's the number of days since that date. When you have that basic understanding of the date works, you can display them using almost any type of format. If you go in the format menu in the Excel, you can select to have it displayed as the 2nd of Jan 2021 or have the year as a number, the month as a number, the day as a number, all together, or you can have them with slashes or whatever you pick. You can change that format very easily if you don't only want to show the last two digits of the year. That's easy to do too. So they have a lot of formatting that you can use. You can even a format that can display based on the date, the day of the week that is going to be. A bonus of using that way of storing date, it makes very easy to do calculation of a date plus or minus a certain number of days. For example, if you type that formula, in like the quote, the 30th of August 2021 plus 15, the first thing that Excel will do, it will translate the 30th of August 2021. It will discover that, oh, this looks like a date. It will convert it to a serial number, add 15, and convert it back to a date. So it will give you the 15th of September 2021. And you can do the reverse. If you do 15th of September 2021 minus the 30th of August 2021, it will convert all of these two numbers to serial numbers, and it will give you the result of 15. And if you inverse these two, it will give you a result of minus 15. So you can figure out if a date is earlier or after a certain date easily. Excel has a number of built-in date functions. I didn't show the argument that you need to put in for all of these functions, but if you begin to type, like if you equate date, for example, the first one, Excel will give you the parameter that is looking for that specific function. So the first one we already saw it is the date function. It returns the serial number of a particular date. The date if function allows you to do calculation number of days, month, or year between two dates. So it's useful to calculate how old is a person. The date value convert a date in the form of a text to a serial number. So indirectly, when we type a date in text, Excel internal to his calculation is using that function. The day function, you give it a serial number, and it will tell you what day of the month that date is. Is it the first, the second, the 10th, whatever. Days with an S will return the number of days between two dates. So there's two arguments. So very similar to what I've done earlier, instead of subtracting them, you put the argument in that function. The days 360 is a special function that use like a normal year of 360 days. I never used that function ever. The e-date return the serial number of a date that is indicated a number of months before or after the start date. So you put, there's arguments to do that. So this is useful if you have something that you've done today, and so I need to revisit again in 5 months. So that function will allow you to do that calculation. The EO month return the serial number of the last day of the month before or after a specified number of months. So again, you can use that if you have like investment that are finishing on a certain date or something like that. You can use these functions to do these calculations. The ISO week number, I never use that function, but if you ever need the ISO week number, there is a way to get that out of Excel. The month function I use a lot. It converts a serial number to a month. So if you give it a serial number, it will return which month of the year that is. Network days, return a number of all working days between two dates. And there's a third argument that you can point to a list. And in that list, you can give the date that are day off, like, for example, the stat holiday or something like that. You can give him a list of these things. And he will, so if the date that you want to know, if it's in, within that range, it will not count that day as a working day. The weekday, return what day of the week that specific serial number is. Week number, it start by numbering each week in a year with week one. So if you, sometime I use that to display the date differently to say this is week one of the year 2021. The year function, return the year of a specific serial number. And the year frac, return the fraction of the year representing the number of complete days between a start and an end date. So with all of these basic built-in Excel function, you can create more complex formula, and probably the most complex one, I didn't create it, I found it on the internet, was to get the Easter date. You can get automate all of these functions if you want to know the Ontario Family Day, like the rule is the third Monday in February, but how can you tell that to Excel so you can compute these dates. So I will go, I will switch to my spreadsheet here. New share. Okay, you should be seeing the spreadsheet now.
We are.
Okay. So I put the year in blue here just to show that this is the only thing that you should be changing on that spreadsheet. It's the input basically. The first calculation that I do is to figure out if that year, 2021, is it a leap year? And you can see the calculation is just basically figuring out if it's a multiple of 400, a multiple of 4, or a multiple of 100. And why I had to use that is many years ago when I was calculating the interest for my mortgage, it took me a while to figure out how to compute the interest the same way that the bank was calculating it. And when I was getting down to the penny, everything was okay until suddenly the number began to be off. And it took me a while to figure out that it was because that specific year was a leap year and I was going to keep their money for one more day and they're going to charge me for the interest for that. So that's why I had to figure out a way that depending if the year was a leap year or not to change the way the interest was calculated. The next thing that I do is these I just typed, like it's all the various months in a month. This is the month number, 1 to 12. This function here use a weekday function, and I use the date function to rebuild the date basically with all the components that we have there. The dollar sign B2 is basically the year, 2021. After that, the month, use the cell just beside it, and it the first, so the day is always the first. And basically in 2021, the 1st of January is going to be on a Friday. The number of days in the month, it varies depending if it's a leap year or not, but there is a formula. You can do the same thing, and there's a trick there. If the number is minus one for the day, he knows to go get the number of days of the previous month. So it's a feature that is that Microsoft put in that formula of the date function. So with that, we can figure out how many days in each of the month using a formula. Now, to do these other specific day that are based on a specific event, like the Ontario Family Day is the third Monday in February. So if we look at the formula here, we take the date, and I left the number in the formula so you can reproduce if you need to do another, like the second Monday in February instead of the third Monday in February. So the third Monday is 3 times 7 plus 1, and the February is the 2 here. And from this, I subtract the number of weekdays that are in that month and for the duration of the 8 minus 2 is 6. So when you plug that formula, and the only input to that is basically the year. So it will return 15 February 2021. And if I want to get the day of the week, I just change the format using the custom feature here. And I say I wanted to use the format. This is an example that you can format a date to say use custom, and for the type here you type DDD, and the three D's will print the day, the weekday, and using three letters. If you put a fourth one, it's going to be the full name of the day. The other date format that I've used often is I can, like the next one, days, it will give 0-1. If you only want, if the number, if you don't want a zero at the beginning, you just use 1D. Dash, if you use a 3M, it will put the month in text with the three letters abbreviation, and the year using the four number for the years. If you only want two numbers, you can use YY. So by using that custom thing in the date here, you can create all the format that you need. But underneath, Excel will keep the full date, so you can do all the calculation correctly. The Good Friday, this one was easy because it's basically 2 days prior to Easter. But to get the date for Easter, holy crap, that function was quite complicated. I didn't design it. I found it on the internet, and I'm just happy that it's working because it's using a lot of MUD function and integer calculation and rounding, but it works. And Easter Monday was also easy. When you have Easter, you can figure out when the Easter Monday is going to be. Just that date plus one day. Victoria Day. This one is the Monday preceding May the 25th. So again, to get that date, there is a bunch of tests that is being done. So depending if the weekday is before 2 is Monday, or Tuesday, it does certain calculations differently, and at the end of the day, based on that formula, it can give you the correct date when it's going to be Victoria Day. The Ontario Civic Holiday is very similar to this one. It's just the first Monday in August. If you look at that formula versus the other one, you can see that the only thing that's changed is that one there instead of, August. We had a 2 there before, that's a 2. Then it's an 8, and the rest of the formula remain the same. And we refer that this one for the Ontario Family Day was the third week, so we had a 3 there. Now we have a 1, so there's only change in that formula. So now you have a pattern. If you're looking for something like the first Monday of September, it's again going to be a very similar formula. The second Monday in October, again, a very similar formula. And the U.S. Thanksgiving, this one's a bit more complicated, is the fourth Tuesday in November. So, again, it does a very similar calculation. So, as you can see, the building function are really useful to design more complex formula. And to show you that that thing is working, if I change it back to, I don't know, the year 2022, all of these numbers will update and the new date will appear. Any questions?
We have some questions or comments in the chat. So first off, I'll mention that as Alan posted into the chat, Stefan will be giving us the Excel workbook. So that'll be posted on our website as well. So if you want to play around with those formulas, you'll have that file for you. Tom asks, how is daylight savings time handled?
I don't think you can handle it very well because I know
daylight savings changes depending on where you are, right? Whether you follow it or not.
Yeah, I know that Outlook does. You can figure out different calendar and handle different times, but I don't think Excel can do it.
Okay. Lauren says, after fighting with variations in how you enter a date in Excel and moving from one computer set to US and another using Canadian regional settings, I believe to have found the universal date entry. So 4-digit year-2-digit month-2-digit day. That is the ISO standard now for international dates. And so I agree. That's the best one to go with.
Oh, yeah. It was always, for a Francophone, it was always hard for me to figure out if you tell me it's going to be like 2021-04-05. Are you talking the 4th of May or the 5th of April?
Yeah. In the international, nobody does year, day, month. So when you have it in the reverse, where is it day, month, year, or is it, you know, month, day, year, you know, so there are differences there, but having a 4-digit year, 2-digit month, 2-digit day, nobody does anything different than that. If you see a 4-digit year, you're safe. Tom asks, can you use DATEIF rather than that lookup table?
For the function to get the number of days, the work days?
I'm not sure that's all Tom had. So, Tom, if you wanted to unmute yourself and ask a question.
Yes. You mentioned the date if function, which actually I haven't come across before. But you could use that to calculate the number of days, and therefore it would always kind of be accurate if you gave it the dates you wanted. I don't know that it would make a difference necessarily in this spreadsheet, but in your, I think it was a loan calculation or something you were calculating before, you would be able to do that.
It's just that sometimes, like, it happens very often that, say, for example, some education, I need to renew it each 44 days. So I know that I renewed the prescription today. So I go in Excel, I type today's date in one cell. And on the next cell, I just put égal, and I click on the cell that has the date plus 44, enter, and Excel give me the next date. So it's very easy to do that calculation.
Okay, and we have from Lawrence, second set of kudos for Stefan. Impressive setup to figure out the Canadian holidays. good stuff. And Tom happens to mention that sorting works properly no matter what the display format, so it is sorted by the date correctly because internally Excel is dealing with it as a serial number. And I think that's it for stuff for you, Stefan.
One last comment to deal with time. The way Excel store is basically a fraction. So the serial number is the integer portion, and the time after that will be the decimal portion of the time that you're trying to do.
Okay. Thanks very much, Stefan.
Okay.
I guess before we go on, there are a couple of things related to earlier stuff. So we did have... Well, unrelated, I'll bring up the Rogers Router stuff if we have time later on. I think there was one other thing. Oh, yeah, there's a little bit of talk about updating Linux and how it's wonderful compared to Windows because you have complete control over it. So it does things in a lot more controlled fashion, or allows you to control the when you update and what you update. So that's good. There was a question about COVID vaccines, getting them online. So somebody posted where you could get the, not a passport, but the proof of vaccination from Ontario Health. So that's in the chat if anybody's interested in that. And the other ones are all related to Rogers routers and things like that. So let's leave that to if we have time.
Okay. We only have a couple more questions anyway.
Yeah.
So the next question is for Chris.
Yeah, so this came in from Natalie, and she was looking at an MP3 player, and it called for a TF memory card as being a requirement for it. And she looked up on the web, and there was some info on the web that said it's different than a micro SD card. Some said it's the same as a micro SD card, just an older version or a different name to it. And she saw one ad for a card that described itself as a micro SDHC Class 4 TF card. So they're trying to cover off everything, I guess. So she was wondering, can a micro SD card be used instead of a TF card that the MP3 player called for. And should she be looking for cards that have TF in the name before she buys one? So I did a little bit of research on it and that, and I found that some information that was mostly on the Wikipedia, which I frequent quite a bit for information, they had some stuff on TF cards. So apparently the CTOs of SanDisk and Motorola, at the time that they were looking at this, they concluded that the memory cards that were on the market at the time were too large physically for mobile phones. So they came up with a new format that they called T-Flash. And T-Mobile issued a cease and desist to SanDisk claiming that they own the trademark to T-anything. And unfortunately, I think, SanDisk and Motorola capitulated to that, and they decided to rename it. So they renamed it to TransFlash. MicroSD flash memory cards were announced in 2005, and according to Wikipedia, microSD and TransFlash cards are functionally identical. However, I found some other information that mentioned that there are some minor differences, and they are really, really oddball differences. And microSD is a superset of TransFlash. So if anything, you get some additional things, and I think it deals with write capability and, you know, turning it off so that it's not writable to the device and you don't accidentally overwrite it, and some things like that that exist in microSD that don't exist in the TransFlash specification. So I think long and short, you're fine to go with either the microSD or TF. I think more things advertise themselves as being microSD rather than TransFlash or T-Flash or anything like that. So, but certainly if you saw a TF card that was significantly cheaper, why not go for it? But I think you're safe to go with microSD as well.
Did you see anything about the capacity? Because I saw that there's limited capacity for the TF card.
There was some information on there, but I don't know what it was. So I think if you look at the second link that you see on the screen, and I pasted that into the chat window as well, there might be some information on that one talking about limitations of size. Potentially, your phone could actually have a limit as well. So if, for example, if TransFlash or TF, say it topped out at 16 gigabytes, potentially, you know, a 32 gig microSD card might not work in it. You know, so they're potentially, they could decide that, you know, a TransFlash only goes up to 16 gigabytes, and they could build it into the phone or the in this case the MP3 player, that it would only accept cards up to, you know, that capacity, 16 gigs or whatever. I think by and large, you're going to have higher capacities, if anything, under microSD, and I would suspect that anything that can read the card, it could handle anything that the specification for microSD can handle, is my suspicion.
Tom is indicating that a TF card will go up to 128 gigabytes, but an SD card will go up to 2 terabytes.
Yeah, that's what I saw in the little that I read about the TF card. Okay.
But as Chris says, it also depends what the phone will support.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So it sounds like you should be good up to 128 gigabytes unless the MP3 player specifically states smaller is its limit. Then I would assume that it takes at least up to whatever the maximum was for TF card, which is 128 gigabytes. But potentially you could be going much higher than that. Tom says the SD card is up to 2 terabytes. So if microSD also supports up to 2 terabytes, then potentially you could have up to 2 terabytes. I'd hate to think of what the cost of the card would be, though.
So basically, as long as the capacity fits, I shouldn't worry about the fact that it lists TF card as what it takes. Okay.
That's everything that I've read seems to indicate that that's the case.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, Chris, we're 8:29, and the last question in the pipe is the Windows 10 help. Do you want to do that, or do you want to put that one off till next week?
Let's do it. I think we can run through it quite quickly. Okay. We might run a couple of minutes over, but let's go ahead and do it.
All right. So this question came into suggestion box just a couple of days ago. A senior, fixed income, wanting to learn about Windows 10, but doesn't want to pay somebody like Best Buy, which I don't know that they do that kind of tutorial stuff anyway. So any advice, tips, or help would be appreciated on how to learn about Windows 10. So I put this on the members forum just to see what people would have to say. And we got a whole raft of options. So first of all, Orion suggested buying one of O'Reilly's products, the missing manual, specifically the Windows 10 manual, which he says he has a copy of and is really good. And O'Reilly do pretty good textbooks on the whole. The ones I've seen have been really good. So that's probably a good recommendation. Bob Walker has two or three different options. He notes that there's lots of them available, but some are pretty old. But he's giving three options here as fairly recent, 2018, 2020 sort of thing. One is Teach Yourself Visually, which is an interesting product if you've seen any of these things. Lots of pictures on how to do things. So it's just like a Q&A PowerPoint presentation, but there's no sound with it. And then a couple of other ones, My Windows 10 Computer for Seniors and Windows 10 for Seniors for Dummies. So I presume that's one of the Dummies series. So those are all available from places like Chapters Generally and Amazon and that kind of thing. But if you're really on a tight budget, Tom Trottier has a really good suggestion. Why not just go to the Ottawa Public Library and search for things? And his search generated a whole bunch of books, ebooks, periodicals, one streaming video, and includes this senior Windows 10 publication, which sounds like it should be a good fit. And then Chris has a number of suggestions.
Yeah, so Windows 10 has some built-in help. So at the start menu, there is a Get Help app that can answer some questions. You can also run the Tips app, and it has some very limited tips on using Windows 10. And then there's the Microsoft Community Forum, which is actually quite comprehensive. They claim millions of questions and answers that have been posted onto the answer forum. So you can go there and you can search on whatever you're trying to learn about. You know, it might be like, you know, how do I copy and paste files or whatever. And so you'll probably find that there's some material already there. And if there isn't, you can actually post the question. And the Microsoft Community Forum is very active, so you're very likely to get somebody that will actually pipe up and come back with an answer for you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Allison's just posted the Connected Canadians website might be an option. And Natalie's saying that the OPL used to have a pair-up program for seniors with students. Not sure if it's being done online or waiting for in person again.
Well, I think the person who emailed in with this, he said that he checked with the Ottawa Public Library, and apparently they are no longer doing whatever program he asked about. And I'm sure if they had that pair-up program still in vogue, they would have told him that that was available. So it sounds like OPL is not doing that anymore.
And iPhone Louis is saying he's a complete newbie who's looking for help using a laptop and one-on-one tutoring. Everything he's heard tonight is so far over his head, he feels like a 10-year-old in university. Oh, dear. I thought that copying files using the GUI was pretty straightforward. All you have to do is try it. Another option I always use for anything that I don't know about is just do a Google search. And if you search for Windows 10 tutorial, you only get about 982 million hits. So one of those would probably help.
Oh, joy.
And finally, you could always join a computer club. And everybody on the call tonight, or most of us, know at least one that has members who help members and monthly meetings and Q&A sessions and a 24/7 online forum. We have newsletters and a website that's got lots of resources. So if you aren't a member, just go to our website, and for $20, it can all be yours.
We also had a comment from Natalie that there's often simple videos on YouTube. And yeah, that's true. If you go to YouTube and do a search there on Windows 10 tutorial, I'd be willing to bet that you would come up with some a whole bunch of videos that you could watch that would have tutorials on various aspects of Windows 10.
Yeah, and a whole pile of those came up in that Google search too. So.
May I interject and say something here?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, I have tried YouTube tutorials. At one time, my computer was locked for some reason. I couldn't even power it up or log in. And I tried following what the tutorial said to fix the problem. And eventually I had to call the people that sold that particular unit to find out how to unlock it. So as far as I'm concerned, YouTube tutorials are useless as tits on a bull.
They can be, but I mean, it's like anything. But if you go out and, you know, ask for a service, you can always get duds. You can also get good ones. So typically the way that I tell people that they might want to consider that is if you go to YouTube, don't rely on one. You know, try a number of them that are on the same topic. And if you end up with several, especially ones that have been around for quite a while, and you can look at the comments that, you know, people say, wow, this really worked for me, or no, this didn't work for me. You know, you can look at the comments and get a sense of whether this is useful information or not. But the other route would be probably a little bit more reliable and more methodical would be to go the book route. So if you wanted to go to the OPL and you could check out books there, there's lots of ebooks available, and they are more likely to take you through a more methodical look at Windows 10 and cover all of the basics, rather than just, you know, somebody throwing up a YouTube video that maybe hits on one particular topic that maybe you're not all that interested in.
I think I agree with you there. Windows for Dummies sounds like a darn good suggestion. Another that I like is getting into one of these community or computer groups or whatever.
Yep.
Like $20 for the year I can afford.
You know. And if you can't afford it, we welcome guests to attend our Q&A sessions and so forth. So for those that really can't afford the $20, it's not a barrier. We're happy to have you here as a guest.
No, what I'm saying is the tutoring can cost, what, $20-$30 and up per hour. Yeah. That I cannot afford.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just that we don't have the mechanisms in place to do one-on-one tutorials. So we have things like this Q&A, and you're more than welcome to, if you have a specific question, pass it in. And like your question on this one, people can chime in and say, I've got an idea about that and so forth, and maybe be able to help you out that way.
Okay, I do have one specific question.
But we're over time now, so if it's real quick.
How do you load Zoom onto your laptop?
For that, if it's a Windows laptop, you can go to zoom.us, and you should be able to find a download link and install it onto your laptop computer. Email me directly if you want, and I can help you out with that if you want.
I don't have your email address.
It's chris.taylor@opcug.ca. So I'm on the OPCUG website. If you look up the executive, I'm listed there. And so feel free to contact me directly, and I can help you out. Alan German just pasted it into the chat window as well, so you can pick
Excellent.
It up there.
Excellent. Thank you very much. You can expect to hear from me.
Okay.
Yeah, just a note, the other thing we've done in the past, we haven't done one recently, is we've had computer workshops where we've done things for beginners, for example.
Yeah.
So there are some options.
We actually ran over than I thought we were going to, so I'll let Alan wrap up the session.
Okay. All right, so we've just got two more slides. And our monthly meeting next month, October the 13th, features our very own Bob Walker, who's going to be talking about the history of the digital revolution. That's on October the 13th, so mark that in your calendar. And our next meeting, our next Q&A session, will be next Wednesday, September 22nd. And as usual, if you have specific questions or things that you would like to share, send us an email to our suggestion box email address. So I hope everybody enjoyed it. Thank you very much for attending, and hopefully we'll see you all next week.
Thanks for coming, folks.